Welcome to the Canteen Podcast, a show for anyone who has feelings about food. Join host Ali Houston as guests open up about their relationship with food and their thoughts on nutrition. Nourish yourself with the Canteen Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Canteen Podcast. I'm your host Ali Houston. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Thanks, and enjoy the show.
So we are recording, and I'm lucky to have with me Grant Schofield, who's Professor of Public Health and Director of the Human Potential Centre in Auckland. I've had him on before, research and teaching interests, wide-ranging from understanding and improving lifestyle behaviours such as sleep, nutrition and physical activity, all the way through to well-being, epidemiology and human performance. He's the author of the book What the Fat, and is, I think, the perfect person to talk to about what's happening just now with coronavirus, understanding the data and what's happening around the world. So thanks very much for coming on, Grant.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Absolutely. So can you talk us through your understanding and thoughts on coronavirus since the time you first heard about it in China until now?
Yeah, I guess we heard about it when it was confined to China. It looked quite deadly. I guess people weren't sure what to do about it as it spread throughout the world, which was sort of inevitable. I guess a landmark point was the Imperial College London's report led by Professor Nigel Ferguson, which modelled probable death, and that was sort of staggeringly high. We all sort of stood up and took some notice of that and said, well, gee, if that's the case, then it's cause for concern because there'll be a lot of deaths. And so I started to talk quite strongly in favour of locking down countries and closing borders and schools and that sort of thing until more that was seemed to be the prudent approach. What shifted me considerably from that were a few things. Is that first of all there was evidence of not full lockdowns but quite strict containment around transmission in places like Taiwan and South Korea and Singapore. And then also my good friend and close colleague, Dr. Simon Thornley, who's also in public health, but he's a public health physician with a much stronger background in infectious diseases than I've got, started to talk me through his experience of the H1N1 swine flu in 2008-2009. And what was interesting about that was the change in case fatality as the disease progressed and more became known about it. So they started with a case fatality rate of between 5 and 11% when it first came out. So it seemed highly dangerous and highly problematic. So that went on for a while. And then 10 weeks into it, which we're into about now, the case fatality had dropped to between 1 and 5% was the estimate. At the end of the day, when all was washed up and when they knew through things like serology and those sorts of things about what the actual case fatality was, it turns out to be 0.02%, which is 5 times less deadly than the seasonal flu estimates. And so you get this sort of tracking down and it's like, well, gee, what if that's, we don't know if that's true yet for what we're seeing in this COVID epidemic, but perhaps that might be true. And then you end up with people, the other one that's been highly influential is John Aides from the States, who's a pretty well-known epidemiologist. And for those in the nutrition world, we know of him because he's criticised nutrition science so heavily over the years. It's going, hey, the true case fatality here is likely to be much lower than currently estimated. There's serious problems with the way that testing gets done. And so I want to talk about that in just a moment. And sampling. So when we're looking at the denominator for case fatality, like how lethal is a disease, you need to know how many people have it in the first place. And actually, at the moment, we have no idea. And if it's much lower than we thought, which it must be, because we must be missing people, then the question is, at what point do we balance in public health harms versus benefits? And so that's really the question of public health. That's what we've always been trying to do in nutrition and population fitness and that sort of thing, is to balance these sorts of things. So to do the most good with the least harm with the resources that we have. As Aedes would say, it's a little bit like an elephant getting attacked by a household cat, and the elephant going into such a panic from the attack of the cat, it accidentally jumps off a cliff and kills itself in the meantime. And you know, perhaps that's possible here. So that's one thing to consider. It may not turn out to be the case, but there's definitely health consequences from chucking the world off an economic cliff, which you can model, and we need to think seriously about, because it's not save lives at any cost. And I think that's been an interesting. Malcolm Kendrick's also done some pieces on this, where he's looked at NHS data and said, what's the cost per quality life year that the NHS is typically prepared to pay? And it's usually about £33,000 is the cutoff. Now, it could be as high as £9 million per quality adjusted life year in the UK, if you say at the low end there of what they're estimating for case fatality. So there's so many unknowns. I think you pulled in two directions with global pandemics, aren't you? Because you'll never have full data when you're asked to act. On the other hand, you're acting in ways that also cause serious harms. You've got ways. Now we're in a position, no matter what we do, we will cause harm. And we have to decide what... Hey, Danny, excuse me. Just stop it. I'm trying to do an interview. Sorry, I've just got kids running around. This is the problem of working at home, is that I've got a kid running around making something in the background. And
it's okay.
It's just distracting me. Therein lies the problem. Like, you're asked to make decisions without full data that have massive consequences. And you're pushed into creating harm one way or harm another way. And you've still got this sort of ethical dilemma. You really, really want to know the case fatality, or in more general terms, the lethality of a disease before you take these other things. And we just don't know that. So that's where we're at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this ethical dilemma is playing out in the public kind of discussion of it in a maybe slightly unhealthy way. I think some people are making it a political thing and saying it's really a choice between saving people, which is the right thing to do, or saving the economy, which is the callous thing to do. Of course,
yeah.
Like you said, Dr. Malcolm Kendrick pointed out that these kinds of decisions must be made in any health service setting, whether it's private or public, because you don't have an infinite number of beds or doctors or nurses or time or drugs or whatever. So you must make these decisions. And the economic impact isn't just on Jeff Bezos's 90th mansion. It's the fact that people commit suicide if they lose their job. They'll be, you know, in lockdown, people get stuck at home and there's more domestic abuse. When, you know, resources in healthcare are put onto one thing, even in a well-funded service, you know, you'll have knock-on effects like cancer patients not getting treated and stuff like that. So, you know, I think you've struck on what I think is the key, which is you have to know the actual number of people that are dying from this and what the likely result is of not having a lockdown. And I mean, what do you think about the countries who haven't had a lockdown but don't seem to have the same giant problems that Italy or Spain have had?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting one, isn't it? And it's hard to know what to make of that, because, you know, it's not a proper science experiment in the way that we can normally understand things, and it's playing out naturally in real time. And so, you know, hindsight here is going to be the most wonderful thing. It's like, well, I told you so, or oops, lucky we did that. And so we just have no idea. We have no idea what's going to play out. My suspicion is, well, the case fatality has to be much lower than it is at the moment. I'll just give you an example that made me think about it. Is 3 weeks ago, I was down at Ironman New Zealand, which is an endurance race. I wasn't doing it, but I was there because I coach an athlete there. I was feeling unwell, had some slightly sore glands, a sore throat, a little bit of a fever. That subsided after a few days, and then it was replaced by a dry cough, which rapidly turned into a lung infection in my left lung. And I was waking up in the middle of the night unable to breathe properly. So I consulted the National Health Line, which you're asked to do because this was just beginning to take off. They decided that was no need of testing because I hadn't come from overseas. It progressed and deteriorated even more. I rang them again. I rang my general practice because I was now isolating at home. The only advice I got was to not worry about it and drink more fluids. And in the end, even to get some antibiotic treatment, which I think was needed because it was now a secondary infection, had to call another GP friend of mine, Glenn Davies, and he prescribed me some antibiotics, which helped, and it's eventually cleared up. But everyone in my house had that with milder symptoms. Several people I know had that, which they presumably caught off me. There may have been asymptomatic cases related to that illness that I had. Was that the COVID-19? Well, I have no idea, but nobody knows that. But it's certainly consistent with all the symptoms. Now, we've only been testing in our country. People have been coming across the border or in contact with people coming across the border. There could be any number of cases. And then there's also the asymptomatic ones. And if Iceland and then more recent Chinese data that have come to light are true, then that's at least half the cases, possibly more. For example, yesterday's date, well, China hadn't been putting in asymptomatic cases into their numbers and have become under criticism for that. They added data yesterday on the new cases, and three quarters of them were asymptomatic. So between half and three quarters of the population have asymptomatic cases, then the denominator is, you know, 3 to 4 times bigger. And so the case fatality is miles, miles different. And that's a pretty crucial thing. The other thing to think about as well is real-time PCR testing for the presence of the RNA and the virus. There's such limited data about the sensitivity and specificity of that. Where you do it, nasal or in the pharynx, test, retest, reliability, whether the sensitivity is even good enough as you have. On the only data that I've seen, which are pretty shoddy data, false negatives run at about 30%. So you're missing 30% of actual cases as well.
Wow.
All of these are astonishing, really. And that's why I'm not sure where that science is at now yet. But if you're looking at, you need an antibody kit to look at people who have ever had or currently have infection from this virus, then you'll know. And that's not going to be very hard to do once that kit's available. You just go and survey. You know, the power of population surveying is such that, you know, with even a sample of a couple of thousand, as long as it's done in a representative way, that is randomly, then you'll have a very good idea about the population-wide infection rate, asymptomatic, and then who's already had it. Then, and only then will you know. But I think that's what we should be talking about.
And so if you think that sort of testing where you take a random sample of the population, you just need a few thousand, and you test for people who have it, who have it asymptomatically, then you get a proper number for the denominator for how many people are actually getting it, and then you can get a decent idea of what the real death rate that we're talking about here is. And then you also test people to see if they've had it already and whether they can, you know, go back to work and not worry about passing it on or catching it. Now, you know, how quickly can you see a country rolling that out, and how expensive is that, and you know, can anyone do it?
Yeah, well, I think the last I heard there was Roche has started to develop such a thing, and a bunch of scientists in Israel have developed such a thing, but getting that to mass production, it's beyond my wheelhouse. I mean, that the trouble is, at least in this country, and I'm not sure what it's like where you guys are, is any public discussion that's not on script is deemed to be killing people, callous, was I think a word you mentioned, and I agree with that's how you're treated. So is letting people die, being callous, inhumane, and just not towing the party line. It's sort of like a wartime situation. We're all in this together. In fact, the advertisements our governments have come up with are pretty much wartime propaganda lookalikes of, you know, we're in this together, and unite against COVID-19 is our slogan. It's, you know, sort of, you know, unite against the enemy. So anything off that script there's no real discussion publicly and in the media around any of the stuff because these things are already assumed. It's assumed that if we don't do anything, masses of people will die, and that's the end of that. So any discussion off script is just socially unacceptable, which I think is disappointing. That's not how science works.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen that a little bit over here where there's been takes that have become very political, where it's posed as a left-right thing, and it's thought to be callous or unfeeling, when in fact maybe that lifting complete lockdown and just trying to isolate more at-risk people and having the debate about what those groups exactly would be and doing the kind of testing that you're talking about would end up in less suffering and less life lost, and certainly more prosperity for people, which is what most people want, you know, even if it's at the lower end of things.
Yeah, I think you mentioned the word about prosperity there, which is true, and I think that's probably one thing we forgot to mention with long-term health harms. If you sort of were to take any sort of social determinants approach, then living in poverty and poor health are so closely interrelated and causal that, you know, that's something we should be trying to avoid at all costs. And at the moment, I think, unfortunately, we're heading for a situation where we have a lot more people living in poverty longer term, and there will be generations dealing with the fallout from the fiscal side of things.
Mm-hmm. And it certainly, you know, raises the question about how prepared we could have been in terms of our health services and social services. But of course, if your whole model is based on taxation of productive activity, which is fair enough, then if you're not doing any productive activity, then you're not producing any taxes.
Yeah, I mean, we're in a perverse situation now in this country where we're coming into a season where there's a lot of harvesting of particularly fruits and vegetables in our farming economy, which is quite big, and they're just getting buried. So first of all, the farmers aren't getting paid for that food. It's not making it to market because we're basically locked down to a single duopoly of suppliers of two supermarkets that supply food for the whole country, and that's the only thing that's open. And so it's just perverse at every level. Now, I do agree, if the death rate of this was 10 times the normal flu, or even maybe 5 times, you have actually got a serious ethical consideration on your hands. How do you deal with that balance? You know, like, at what point do you go, yeah, we need to do something serious here, or not? And I actually have no idea what the answer to that number is. Clearly, at the same as the seasonal flu, we've got a precedent for not doing anything much and just trying to protect the most vulnerable. But at some point, that obviously changes. If the death rate was 10%, well, you would be probably doing something. But what do you do for everything in between? I have no answer to that. And those aren't even my decisions.
Yeah. And so do you know if there's a definitive point of origin? Is it coming from these wet markets in China, to the best of your knowledge, or you know, there's some other crazy rumors going about that it might be something man-made or from elsewhere. I mean, how certain are you that it's from these wet markets in China?
I've got no idea. I mean, interestingly, and perversely, I've actually was just at the same time, and I'm only three quarters of the way through it. I've been reading a novel from Stephen King called The Stand, in which, I don't know if people are familiar with this, but US government manufactures a deadly virus called the superflu, which somehow gets out of their labs. And unfortunately, the superflu has a case fatality rate of 99.9%. So it's the end of the whole population, except for the small bands. One, the good guys end up in Boulder, Colorado, and the bad guys, aptly enough, in Las Vegas, and they go at it. So there is sort of a history of that sort of apocalyptic novel writing in the genre of what you're suggesting, but yeah, who knows? I assume it's biological. I mean, these things exist in nature, and that's just what happens when you're an organism on a planet. I think, you know, if you take a square centimeter of seawater, there's millions of viruses, mostly completely harmless, just even there, just randomly. So if you're looking to avoid viruses and what come with them, or bacteria, then you're on the wrong planet.
Yeah, I think that's either a very disturbing or a very relaxing way to look at it. I mean, I really want to get a virologist on, because it'd be nice to hear, you know, their take on it. I mean, my understanding of how we've evolved is that we owe part of our complexity to viruses. You know, it's an arms race, and it's a selection pressure in evolution that we survive through genetic mutation that happens to help us navigate the environment we find ourselves in. And viruses are trying to do exactly the same thing. So we're fighting against each other. So we're constantly mutating and evolving. And the viruses that replicate by making humans ill wouldn't exactly survive all that long if they killed everyone.
No, and that's the other thing. I mean, I've just been doing a few lectures on gut health. And if you take Graham Rock's old friends hypothesis, which is that, you know, the sort of update from the hygiene hypothesis, that we've evolved in a way that the microorganisms in our gut, which include bacteria, fungi, and viruses, then they really provide the software, in other words, the programming to be a homeostatic human. And, you know, people talk about the microbiome and the actual bacteria, but we're not talking about the microbiome, so the sheer billions of viruses that exist in our gut, and then there's the bacteriophages, which are really a combination of the bacteria being invaded by the RNA from the virus and what those do. So there's just a whole bunch of complexity in normal human homeostasis as far as nutrition and that sort of stuff's concerned anyway, around these things. So they're just everywhere. And presumably from time to time, because of DNA sequencing and RNA replication, something's going to go amiss and it's going to be nasty. So I assume that's what's happened.
And we're in the dark, we're almost in the dark ages when it comes to all that, because it's such a new field, and it's the complexity is, like you say, it's mind-boggling. I mean, do you think it's fair to characterize this coronavirus as something that's effectively seasonal already? Or do you think this new variation could establish itself as a seasonal thing that comes and goes forever? Or is there any way to avoid that?
Yeah, probably could. And I tell you what's interesting about that is the differences in mortality, as far as we can tell, between countries that are coming out of summer seasons and not. So Australia is a reasonably large country, but and it's got a reasonable number of infections confirmed, and then a whole bunch not confirmed. And they've got 20 odd deaths at the time we record this. And New Zealand is approaching nearly 1,000 cases with one death. One older woman comorbid with COPD already. So it's like, well, we're not, and then you go to sort of more heavily polluted countries that are coming out of winter with elderly populations like Italy and New York, Wuhan and China, and they have different experiences. So perhaps that's just the seasonality of it, and maybe you're protected from this because of natural levels of vitamin D from sun exposure and these sorts of things. We just don't know.
And do you think this will or should change the way we see public spaces in the future? You know, for example, should we lower the capacity of venues or bars? Should we permanently stay at a distance from each other or wear masks like they tend to do more in the Far East, or bow instead of shake hands or anything like that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it? I don't know the answer to that. I think I was thinking about how it might change the world on a more macro level, is that the sort of globalization that we're comfortable with and travel anywhere for meetings, and the expectation of that as being a normal thing. I mean, I actually hope that will change. I hope the sort of globalization of tourism, particularly for my country, will be less. I mean, what's obvious in our country is our complete reliance on low spend tourists here, and therefore economic collapse without that. So that seems ridiculous. Our complete reliance on a global supply chain and global food supply, especially the food supply. Now, at least in New Zealand, we're lucky because we produce 50 times more food than we can eat, so we're not going to starve. But instantly, within a week of being locked down, we've run out of things that we don't make. Like, we don't make flour, probably a good thing anyway. But yeah, that's no longer available in the supermarkets because it's not a thing. Yeah, we're not going to run out of beef and lamb or these sorts of things because we've got plenty of them. But I think that's what hopefully will change. As for the social aspects, yeah, maybe it will. Maybe some of these businesses will never reopen. Maybe cinemas, as we know them, won't reopen. It's because of this, and they're on the edge of being a business anyway. And maybe there's a whole lot of things that are on their way out that will never come back. Interaction in public spaces and sports events, I can't see those stopping. People, there's still football fans will go and watch, you know, the local Liverpool derbies. There'll still be 100,000 people there doing whatever they do. I'm sure of that.
Yeah, well, it will be interesting to see how it evolves. Do you know if there's any way of knowing for sure if you've had it without this, without antibody testing? I mean,
No, I'm not. For a while they've been spruiking the idea of doing CT scans as the best possible diagnosis, but there's now doubt on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hey, the other thing I think is worth mentioning, Ali, that we haven't sort of said so far is, and it seems to be a discussion that particularly a lot of people are very uncomfortable about having, and I've really struggled with my older parents with this, is when they say, well, there were older people here, they were going to die, they may not have died of that cause, but they died at this time, and they probably would have died at this time anyway. That just appears to completely freak people. And it's, with my dad, for example, who's nearly 80 and actually has cancer, he's just going, well, you're just throwing away the key of throwing the old people to the wolves, and it's all right for you people because you still be around. And that seems to be a discussion that is very, very emotive. And then, you know, obviously when you're talking in public health talks, like things like excess mortality or, miscoding cause of death. For example, an old man dies of a heart attack but happens to be positive for COVID-19, then at the moment he's coded as dying from COVID-19, and the normal world, before the end of the world, that would have been coded as cardiovascular disease or myocardial infarction as a cause of death. And so getting that message and having a discussion about that in general public seems to be, you know, almost impossible, because we're not very good at talking about death. People talk about the sheer numbers of death, like, you know, just to put it in perspective, 1 million people died last week in the world. In the UK, 10,500 died of all causes, and that happens every week. And you wonder what would happen if we started following things that closely. And then people are like, well, Italy exists and Spain exists, and that's true, they do exist. We need to understand those better. On the other hand, I think people don't realise if they've been in a working hospital, that, and you mentioned this earlier, that every day decisions are made whether to admit people to intensive care units and whether to ventilate them, and whether that would be worthwhile. And so there's a massive public discussion and a rush to make and produce ventilators. That's sort of like, you know, making more Spitfires for the war effort, is really interesting, because when you actually look at the survival of people with COVID-19 who are ventilated, it's pretty woeful. For example, a study in The Lancet was the first 197 patients at Wuhan. 54 died. Of those 54, all 54 were ventilated. None of them survived, but there were only actually 56 people who were ventilated, and only two survived. And so we're now admitting people to ICUs with very low chance of survival, and probably in normal times they just wouldn't be admitted. They would be given palliative care. So we've changed our view on what would happen there. But any discussion about that in public has just seemed to be beyond anything. And to do that is basically throwing away the key to people's lives and not treating people as humans. And it's not the intention at all. The intention is to be as save as many lives as possible and cause the least harm for the resources we have. That social ability to have those scientific discussions is an issue.
Yeah, well, I was going to talk to you about that. You know, that you've written about how much improvement there could be in people's lives if they change their lifestyle, their diet, exercise, sleep, and so on. And there's this big surge of opinion from the general public at the moment that you don't tend to see, except maybe with elections. And you know, this level of public engagement on health could be seen afterwards as a silver lining, but it depends how it evolves. You know, do you have hope that this might actually engage people more in talking about health in a good way?
Well, it could do, because now it turns out that even with contagious communicable diseases, that the main thing that predicts your risk of death, or you're giving on the glass half full side, your chance of survival, is not having metabolic syndrome and being metabolically healthy. And we all know the role that food and stress and sleep and exercise have in that, particularly food. So perhaps that will be the case. On the balance of history, it won't be. I'm even astonished in basic health economics. It's like, well, this guy's got type 2 diabetes, dialysis, that's costing £100,000 a year. Can we do some pre-diabetes diet interventions? So like, how much does that cost? And we think, well, it's going to cost about $500 a person, and you know, we just get laughed at. We haven't got any money for that. So, on the basis of existing economics, no, I'm not optimistic. On the basis of being forever hopeful, yeah, I'm hopeful. And that's why I guess you and I exist, is mostly just sort of drive change in that direction.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. I mean, what do you think is the best course of action right now in terms of keeping things under control? And I know we're still waiting for the best data, but I'll take a couple of examples. You know, like a friend of mine who has a 81-year-old mother, and you know, she's worried about self-isolating. Should he talk, you know, to her from a distance through a window with a mask on, or can he go into her house, or should he just stay away from her altogether? Or what do you think about that at the moment?
Yeah, I think I'm doing that with my parents, and well, first of all, I have to by law now, but I would have anyway. And my wife's parents, they're both older with mostly some comorbidities, so I think that's prudent. At that level, is that prudent at a population level? That's a completely different question, which it's not probably my job to answer. Yeah, so I'd be prudent as we get to the final answer with at-risk groups. I think for low-risk groups, basic social distancing, hygiene, and that sort of thing are going to be part of what goes on for the next several months. Full lockdowns of the sort that we're in now with police-enforced situations, I'm not sure how sustainable that was. I think there's only a certain amount of that the public will take, and I think the answer is not that much. At the moment, we have a ridiculous situation. I saw one yesterday. So there's like an older man just down at the beach having a little swim by himself. Police come down there and haul him out. You know, it's like you're putting the lives of the community at risk by being out here. So you need to exit the water immediately. And you're like, you know, by all logical purposes, you're going, how? It's an old guy swimming by himself in the shallow water. We've still got the end of summer here, so it's quite nice. Like, really? You know, I've been sneaking off on some bike rides out in the countryside, completely deserted, just with the sheep and the cows. You know, hoping the police don't drive past and catch me. You know, it's sort of weird. that's where it's gone.
So it might be that people who are really at risk, maybe people with type 2 diabetes, you know, heart disease, that kind of thing, maybe should be looking at the next sort of few months, maybe keeping the risk low by staying at home, but that you're hopeful that we can get better data to make more sensible targeted decisions in the near future.
Absolutely spot on. Agree with your summation. Absolutely.
Brilliant. Well, I think I've covered all I wanted to, and it's been really great talking to you again. As usual, I'll put the links to your website and Precure and for the book, whatthefatbook.com. Hope you stay safe, and thanks again for coming on.
Yeah, and thanks, and all the best to you guys over there as well. So have a good one.
Thanks, Grant.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Thanks, and see you next time.